Yeah, thank you so much for the introduction. I'm Robert, and today I'll be talking about learning to predict arbitrary quantum processes. This is a joint work with Sutan Chen and John Preskill. So in the recent years, there's been a lot of progress in understanding how to efficiently learn and make predictions about many-body quantum systems, in particular focusing on quantum states, such as the development in shadow tomography, in learning about Gibbs state, like a quantum thermal states, and in many other contexts. And in today's talk, I would like to address something that were less well explored and less understood, which is the task about learning to predict quantum circuits and quantum processes. So being able to understand such a question could potentially be useful in, say, designing new catalysts and designing new pharmaceutics or understanding quantum matter or quantum devices. In today's talk, we'll be focusing on the following specific setting, which is we would like to train an ML model to learn and predict the following function. So the function takes in two objects. The first is an n-qubit state rho, and the second object is an n-qubit observer O. And then, given these two objects, the model will try to predict a real value given by this Fe of rho of O, which corresponds to putting in this initial state into some unknown quantum process E, and then measuring the observable O at the end. So such a function is very general. It represents anything that's computable by a quantum computer. And if we really don't impose anything about the quantum process E, then in general, it could just be an exponentially deep quantum circuit. So computing such a function could also require a very long time. However, yes, for most practical purposes, we're going to focus on cases where this CPT map E is efficiently generatable. So now when would this type of question arises? For example, one of the canonical one is, say, we wanted to predict outcomes of physical experiments. So in this example, once you think of the initial state as described by some classical input X, it describes, say, how the initial set of molecules are being it's been set. And then this unknown process E would be the physical process that happens in the experiment. So you evolve the systems, entangling them or turning them into some completely different states. And then at the end, the scientist would measure something in the experiments, and that's described by this observable O. The second example arises in the study of quantum machine learning, where people have been very excited about training quantum neural network. And that also fits into this framework. Because in that setting, one could think of this unknown CPT map E as a parameterized quantum circuit. People also call this a quantum neural network, where they try to tune the parameter in the circuit to train this quantum neural network so that it produces the desired functionality that one trains it with. And in those kind of cases, usually this observable is a fixed quantity, a fixed object. So you don't try to change O. All you try to change is this rho. So this rho encodes some classical vector. Maybe it's an image, maybe it's something else. And then you pass it through the parameterized quantum circuit, and then you measure a fixed observable at the end. And the goal is to be able to train and understand what that CPT map should be, what that quantum circuit should be. So such an example also fits into this setting. It's just a special case of this setting. And another example that this task arises is, say, we wanted to speed up some complex quantum dynamics. So say there are some quantum dynamics that requires a very long time to implement, or when we try to do it on a quantum computer, maybe it requires many, many quantum gates. So it's very costly to run such a quantum dynamics. And what we're hoping to have here is that perhaps the ML model can learn a compressed representation of that long-time quantum dynamics. So then when we try to predict what would happen for different input states, we don't have to run that quantum dynamics again. We can just utilize the learned model, which is hopefully a much more compressed and much more low-complexity representation that can just be used to make the prediction very much more efficiently than running that very deep circuit again. So these are some examples that people have looked at. from a more heuristic angles. And in this work, we would like to understand from a more rigorous perspective, what can we actually say about such a task? Like, is it really possible that an ML model can learn and predict such a function? Or are there certain hardness results and so on? But that's going to be covered by this work. More generally, the goal of this work is that we're given some n-qubit CPTP map E that describes some highly complex quantum circuit or highly complex quantum process. It's just a more generalized version of quantum circuit. And what we were going to do is we're going to do some experiments on this CPTP map, maybe by putting in some state and performing some measurements to construct a data set. We would then use that data set to create a learned model, and hopefully a much lower complexity learned model, so that given properties of the input state, the learned model will allows us to predict what's the properties of the output state. So that's going to be the goal of today's talk and also of this work. And the talk will be separated into these three different parts. I will begin by looking at a classical version of this problem. And this classical version of this problem has been very well studied. People know the complexity since like maybe 30, 40 years ago. And then I will talk about a restricted version of this problem, how it's different to the classical version. Like, is it easier or is it actually harder? And then finally, generalize, use the insights and generalize it back to the original quantum problem. I'm going to begin with the first part on talking about a related classical problem. So the classical problem is as follows. There is some high complexity classical Boolean circuit that takes n bit input and produces n bit output. So instead of having quantum process, we look at a classical Boolean circuit. And now the input is just a bit string. And for simplicity, we're going to utilize a 1 and negative 1 instead of 0 and 1, but they're essentially the same. And say at the end, we just wanted to predict the first bit of the output bit string, so the first output bit of this Boolean circuit. And now we can write down this function, the input to the output, as this function fc of x that depends on this Boolean circuit c. And in a quantum way, one can write it out as trace of z1, where we have this Boolean circuit applied onto the density matrix xx, and that gives a real value that's either 1 or negative 1. In a more general quantum case, this function would take value between 1 and negative 1. But here for classical, it would just always be 1 or negative 1. So now one can ask, what's the complexity of learning such a function? And understanding complexity, the first thing that people would try to do is understanding the worst case complexity. So in the worst case complexity, we would like to learn a model, that is, learn some hypothesis model, h of x, such that for all the input x, h of x and the true value, fc of x, differs by a small constant. So what's the complexity of that? So if we don't impose anything about the classical Boolean circuit, then in general, this function fc, which takes in this bit string and spits out 1 or negative 1, is equivalent to an exponentially long vector, where each entry corresponds to the output when we're given a specific input x. So it's an exponential, it's a 2 to the n long vector with no structure in it. It's just an arbitrary vector. So every classical Boolean circuit corresponds to some arbitrary vector. So in this case, when we wanted to learn a model such that it matches up with fc of x, the query complexity has to scale exponentially. Because if you don't know, if you haven't queried a specific x before, then you have no way of predicting what that value is, because there's no structure. So it could be 1 or negative 1. So knowing about others doesn't tell you anything about a specific point. So if you wanted to get this worst case guarantee, then the amount of query has to scale as 2 to the n. It's actually just exactly equal to 2 to the n. And things are not much better when we consider the average case. If we would like to learn a model h of x such that for a uniformly random sampled x, the average error between h of x and the true value fc of x is upper bounded by 0.5, one can easily show that you still need to query fc of x for at least half of them. because there is no structure. So when you see some of them, you have no idea what the others are. So now if you wanted to get an average error of 0.5, then you need to see at least half of them. Otherwise, you cannot get that. And hence, the complexity, the query complexity scale grows exponentially in system size. And that's all because there's no structure. And the same question is still, I mean, and actually, very recently, people have been studying it for more structured classical Boolean circuit, say a very shallow classical circuit. One example of that is a constant depth classical Boolean circuit with majority gate. So the formal name of it is also called TC0. And that's people often use TC0 as like a theoretical model for modeling constant depth shallow neural network in a Boolean setting. So this paper by Srinivasan Anurachalam and his friends showed that even when you have this very restricted version, like a shallow classical circuit, if you wanted to learn a model such that its average error is bounded by a constant, like 0.5, it's still computationally very hard. One would expect some super polynomial scaling in order to do this. And it's true for both classical and quantum computer. Even if you have a quantum computer, a fault tolerant one with like many, many qubits, learning a shallow classical circuit is still a very hard task. So people have been studying this problem on the classical realm for quite a lot of times since like 30, 40 years ago when people developed this framework called pack learning. And people have been just been proving a lot of negative results saying that, oh, this you cannot learn, oh, that you cannot learn. Even for shallow circuit, you cannot learn. And so it's really quite challenging task. Like learning in general is pretty hard. Now what we would like to do is we would like to look at a version of the quantum problem and see what's the hardness and what's the complexity for learning that. So recall that what we've been looking so far is a classical problem where the input, you can think of it as on the block sphere, on the pole, either on the north pole or the south pole. And we would like to predict the first bit. And we know that this is exponentially hard, a very hard task. Now we can look at a more restricted version of the quantum problem, where instead of having a classical Boolean circuit, we have a quantum process. And instead of having a classical bit string input, we have a product state input. So now the input is a bunch of qubit living on the block sphere. And the goal is to, again, still predict the first qubit on the output state. And we would like to understand, is this task actually harder than the previous task? Particularly throughout the talk, I'm going to utilize the Heisenberg evolved state. Essentially, we can just combine the complex quantum process with Z1 to generate an observable O. So predicting the output state property is just the same as predicting what's the observable O acting on the input state. And now what we're going to look at is we're going to look at a very simple classical data set. Essentially, what we do is we just put in a bunch of random product states. On each qubit is sample in terms of hard measure. And then we measure in the first bit. So it creates this classical data set that tells us something about this observable O, which looks like the following. So we run it for n repetition. So now each repetition, we have an input product state written as psi L that maps to a single value YL, where the expectation value of YL is equal to the observable O, like the expectation value of observable O on this input state. And the prediction test is essentially the following. We have this classical data set that tells us about, for different random product state, what's the corresponding output. And now what we would like to do is, given a new state, a new product state, psi, we would like to be able to predict the expectation value of O accurately. So in the classical problem that we look at, this O is essentially a diagonal matrix. That's that exponentially long vector corresponding to this function fc. And each of these states psi would just be a classical bit string. But now we generalize it a little bit. So now this observable could have off-diagonal values. And this psi would just be some product state. So it also has some like off-diagonal values. We can first begin by looking at the worst case harness. basically what we can show is that one can easily show is that if you wanted to learn a model etch such that it matches up with the true value up to some constant error for all the input state, this problem is at least as hard as the classical one. Because in the classical case, because you can just pick the product state to be equal to all these bit string, kind of in the same as classical case. And one can also just focus on an instance, a subset of the problem where this observable is guaranteed to be diagonal. And now we're back to classical case. And hence this worst case problem is at least as hard as the classical one. So the query complexity for solving this worst case prediction problem would still grow exponentially in system size. It's not very efficient. And then similar to the classical case, we can also look at the average case hardness. Suppose what we would like to do is to learn a model such that for a random product state, a new random product state, the average prediction error is bounded by a constant. So previously in the classical problem that we looked at, this is still exponentially hard. But now, what's quite surprising is that in the quantum setting, like this quantum version, the problem actually becomes much easier and can be solved in quasi-polynomial time. And that's essentially what I'm going to be diving deep into on why this is the case and what's the underlying ideas that really differentiate between the classical problem and the quantum problem. Because usually one would intuitively think that quantum should be harder than the classical, but somehow this version, in the average case, it becomes much easier than the classical. And one of the key ingredients in establishing this result is low-weight approximation. So basically, what we do is we can take this observable, which corresponds to the output state property acting on the input state. We can expand it in terms of the Pauli basis. And now we just throw away all the Pauli terms that have high weight. So if a Pauli term acts on more than k qubits, then we just throw them away. And now we create this low-weight approximation, a low-weight observable O low, that hopefully approximates O. And it actually does, because in the paper, we proved the following lemma, which states that on average, when we sample a new psi, the difference between psi of O and versus that on O low decays exponentially in terms of k. So as you select some k that's slightly large, then this difference will decay very quickly and quickly go to zero. Another way to think about this inequality is that for most of the product state, when we evaluate the output on O, it will be very close to when we evaluate it on the low weight observable O low. And this is a very big difference between the, fair question.
I'm sorry, you explained it but I wonder if you could clarify again. This is an average case result. So can you say again what the distribution is on the inputs?
Yeah. So for this case, for this part when we were talking about it, the distribution would just be there's a bunch of qubit, and each qubit is it's a hard random, okay. A single qubit hard random state. So like a random, that's when I say random product state, that's what I meant. And this is really a big difference between the classical and the quantum case. Because in the classical version of this problem, there's no such thing as low weight approximation. This lemma doesn't hold in the classical case. And basically what happens, like when you take average over not random product state, but just random basis states, what could happen is that this difference, no matter how big even if you take a k to be very, very large, like extensive, like k around order n, it can still be a constant. So it doesn't decay in terms of k. And that's what differentiates between the two. And that's why the classical version is actually much harder and the quantum version becomes much easier. Another way to think about this is as follows. So in the case of classical, all the inputs are perfectly distinguishable from one another because they're just basis states, they're orthogonal to one another. And knowing one doesn't tell you anything about all the other. On the other hand, in the quantum state case, because these are like random product state and they could have overlap, they're not perfectly distinguishable. And because they're not perfectly distinguishable, what actually happens is knowing about the one quantum state actually tells you a lot of information about the other quantum states. And that kind of overlap of information is captured by this low-weight approximation. So essentially, that's the information that that kind of share across everything. And hence, by capturing this O-low, you can, by having this O-low, it tells you kind of how all the different quantum states are related in a generated case.
Question?
Yeah.
Where does the 3 in the previous slide come from?
You mean like why is it a 3? That's a good question. So right now we're using like the proof of this is related to this concept called D designs. And when you have like a 2 design, which arises when you look at second moments, like this squared thing here, when you have a single qubit 2 design, this kind of constant of 3 pops up kind of naturally. So that's where it comes from. I'm not sure if it's typed though. So it could be that this is just an artifact. Like maybe it's 4 or something. But right now what we can prove is that it's 1/3 to the k. So this is just an upper bound. So I'm not yet sure if that actually reflects the true reality. Like what's that expectation value actually is. Like, yeah. But it is at least bounded by that.
Yeah, we are talking about qubit.
Yes.
We are talking about qubits. Would the bound depend on the local Hilbert space dimension?
Yeah, that's a good question. So here we are qubit, and then that gives rise to 3 to the k. I think if it's qubit, then it would be d plus 1 to the k. At least like going through the proof, I think. It would be the same, but it would be this is upper bounded by 1/d+1 to the k instead of. So this kind of match up. Because here d is 2.
This also is with the intuition on the next slide, because the quantum states on the bigger Hilbert space is more indistinguishable.
Yes, in a sense, yes. Like for each of them, they're more indistinguishable.
Thanks.
Another question.
Yes.
The feature that you point to as being what discriminated the classical quantum was, you know, indistinguishability. If I sample each of those states and the product state from the 6 stabilizer states,
yes,
I would also have indistinguishability.
Yes.
Would your results?
It would apply.
But we, you know, I can make a much better analogy between those guys and probability distributions on 2 classical bits.
Uh-huh.
So that, to my mind, the stabilizer case ought not to be sort of genuinely non-classical.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that from this perspective.
Yes, from this perspective, that would still be. So in a sense, it's like some version of the classical problem we will still get this and we can learn efficiently. I guess that's another way to think about it. So yeah, so this whole thing still applies because stabilizer forms the 2 designs. So all the calculation would go through and you would still get 1/3 to the k, you still get decay. So yes, if you just pick like the 6 points, that would still apply. Okay. There's no more further question, then I will continue. So yeah, so essentially this low approximation works and that gives rise to a very basic and simple idea for how to construct the ML algorithm. Essentially, instead of learning this observable O, what we aim to do is we learn this low weight approximation, which is a much more restricted observable. Because it's when you write down in the Pauli basis, it only contains K body terms. You can think of it as like a K local Hamiltonians or just a sum of like these k-body observables. And we can just pick a small k so that 1/3 to the k is very small and then we're happy. So that's kind of the idea. And in order to learn the low weight of observable, what we're going to do is we're going to use this lemma, which is essentially a Fourier transform on the Pauli group, using the Pauli group. Basically, it states that when you take these yl from the classical data set, multiply by what's the expectation value of a single Pauli string P on the input state, multiply them, and average over this entire data set, the expected value, that is when we sample this data set for many, many times and then average all of them, it will be equal to this alpha P. So that allows us to get a good estimate for what alpha P is. However, there's going to be fluctuation when we consider finite samples. If we take n to be infinite, then there's no fluctuation. We can learn alpha p exactly. But when there's only a finite sample, there could potentially be quite a bit of fluctuations in the alpha p value. And since there's a bunch of different p, a bunch of different Pauli operator, and all of which has a fluctuation, it could be that the low weight observable from a small number of capital N will not accurately capture what the true low weight observable is. So one question that arises here is, how large should the data size N be so that we can actually accurately reconstruct this observable, this low weight observable? And what we're going to talk about is, quite surprisingly, we only need capital N to be log in the system size. The small n is like the number of qubits that we care about. So if it's like a 100 qubit quantum process, I actually only need to take a log of it, and that's the training data size we need. So in order to show this result, it requires some new insight. So not just the low-weight approximation, but also another insight that comes from this inequality that was proved in our paper called the Bonnenbloss-Hill inequality, a quantum version of the Bonnenbloss-Hill inequality, which is a very old result and not super old, like 50 to 100 years old result in harmonic analysis. And in order to prove that result, we have to look at a completely different task, and that's what I'm going to talk about. It's on optimizing quantum Hamiltonians. Here's an interlude that I'm going to just jump away and talk about very different things, and then later on I will come back and show how the results and the ideas that we gain from here can be used in this learning context. So this is also a commonly studied task. David Gossett has also worked on it. And the task is the following. We're given some n-qubit k-local Hamiltonian H, and the goal is to find a state that either maximizes or minimizes the energy. So like in the task of finding ground states, one would like to minimize the energy, and in the task of like performing some optimization task, perhaps we would like to maximize the energy. In particular, here, for our learning purpose, we want to have a guarantee. We don't just want a heuristic algorithm, we want to have a rigorous algorithm that can have a guarantee on the energy that we get based on the description of the Hamiltonian edge, based on the geometry of the Hamiltonian, as well as the Pauli coefficient alpha p. In particular, in order to talk about that, we have to define what we call an expansion property. So we say a Hamiltonian has an expansion coefficient CE and a dimension DE if the following is true. Say if we look at every size DE region in the n-qubit system, the number of Pauli terms that are fully covered by that region or fully covers that region is at most CE. So to give an example, say D is 2, so that's, we look at size 2 region in an n-qubit system, and say the region R is this gray area, guys. Then some Pauli terms will satisfy this. For example, this Pauli term, which has a domain that's exactly matched up with R, it will count. And such a Pauli terms that look like this, which has a domain that entirely covers this, would also count in here. And then finally, if it's fully covered by this, that's also part of it. So we just count how many Pauli terms there are in this Hamiltonian with a non-zero alpha p coefficient. And say we wanted to say something like, oh, it's at most CE. So that's what we call an expansion property. And to give more intuition, here are some examples.
This CE, is that different from the number of terms that intersect the region that you're choosing?
It would be slightly different because the Pauli term may act on these two qubit, and then the region is these two. Then those Pauli terms would not count. It would only count when it's fully covered by this region or fully covers the region. So it's just slightly different from intersecting. And yeah, so to give some intuition, here are some examples on different Hamiltonians that arises and what's their expansion property. So say if we look at a geometrically local Hamiltonian, then the expansion dimension would be 1. Because for every qubit, the number of Pauli terms that acts on it is bounded by a constant because it's geometrically local. So every qubit is only acting by a constant number of Pauli terms that kind of covers it. So we can just pick D equals to 1 and CE is just a constant. On the other hand, when we have a general k-local Hamiltonian, where there's like a non-local k-body terms, it doesn't have to be geometrically local, k-body terms, then its expansion property is the following. It's that the dimension is equal to k, because for every k region, one can easily show that the number of Pauli terms that are of this form is upper bounded by 4 to the k. So usually once you think of it as CE is just a constant, it can be kind of large and it doesn't really change too much of the structure. But DE is the more important part. Like if DE is 1, it really means it's kind of geometrically local. But when it has like this kind of long range interactions in the Hamiltonians, then DE start to grow. And the more body and the more highly entangled it has, it becomes, and DE grows bigger and bigger. For example, if you have like a 4 local Hamiltonian, like in SYK, then DE would be like 4, and so on. And the final example is, say we have a degree D 2-body Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian is 2-body. It can connect very far away to points, but it's degree D, meaning that every qubit is only acted on by D observables. In that case, one can show that CE is like 16D, 16 coming from 4 squared, which is like the number of Pauli terms on 2-body, and DE would also be 1. So these are just some examples to help visualize a little bit what this expansion property actually means. And basically, in this work, we proved the following theorem for an optimization algorithm, which shows the following. It says there exists an algorithm that can find either a maximizing product state psi such that its energy is greater than a random state plus this kind of advantage term. Or it can find a minimizing product state psi such that its energy is lower than the average by minus this kind of advantage term. So it's kind of reminiscent of a work that David Gossett had, but the form is quite different. And I think in various cases, this actually improves upon the scaling. In particular, we can see where some of these expansion property pops up. It pops up here, but this is just like some constant, so we don't really care about it. It's just some small constant. And it also pops out here. It grows exponentially in the k local part. And then it also pops out in this r value. We can see that the r value corresponds to 2DE over DE plus 1, which is a value between 1 and 2. So I'm not sure how people are familiar with like 1 norm and 2 norm. But when things are in 1 norm, that's usually much bigger than when it's in 2 norm. So if DE is just 1, then we get R equal to 1, and then we get like a 1 norm type advantage. Versus when DE is very, very large, then in that case, we only get a R equal to closer to 2, and then the advantage becomes a 2 norm of the alpha P. And that's much smaller than when you get 1 norm. So intuitively, once you think of it as when DE becomes bigger and bigger, then it becomes much harder to optimize. And the advantage we get becomes smaller. But when D is small, like in a geometrically local Hamiltonian or a bounded degree Hamiltonian, then this R equals to 1, and you get like a 1 norm type advantage. So like 1 norm and 2 norm is like it's like whether you sum up the squared versus you sum up the absolute value, and then also you normalize it.
And this is now a fully classical algorithm?
Yeah, this is a fully classical algorithm, and it finds a product state.
You say either does one thing or the other thing?
Yes.
You don't know which one it's going to do?
I don't know which. I cannot guarantee which one it does. Kind of weird statement. But actually, I think in the literature on this quantum optimization, this kind of statement has also popped up before. It's like, it's related to kind of like you can find a direction. I'll talk about it later, but it's related to like you can find a direction where you can either like push your state so that it has much higher energy, or you can push it so that it becomes lower, but you can only push it in one way. And then the other way, you're not sure. So this type of idea also appears I think there's a time when people were very excited about QAOA, where you can use QAOA to like improve like different type of problems. And Eddie Farhi has cooked up a proof that says QAOA can achieve some kind of a rigorous guarantee. And then a big group of like theoretical computer scientists come together and show that actually you can achieve that. You can actually do it even better using a classical algorithm. And during that, in that proof, they also have something like this. Like they either find a maximizing bit strings or like a minimizing one. So this type of things does appear. It feels a little bit strange, but it's kind of common.
What do you mean by the dimension of a Hamiltonian? Sorry if I missed this.
Oh, yeah. It was actually talked about here. The expansion dimension corresponds to like this kind of setting. Just to get like geometrically local, dimension is one. But if you have like a general K local Hamiltonian, meaning that there's like all possible K body interactions, then the DE becomes like K.
Like a geometric dimension or something.
Yeah, some version of that. Kind of like how the qubits are being connected by this Hamiltonian. So that's it.
Sorry, what was theta in that formula that you had? I didn't understand.
Oh, which?
That's like, what is theta there?
Oh, you mean this one? Oh, that's just like the asymptotic notion. So it's like big O, but big theta means like it's really just a constant. But because big O can be like K is big O, K log K, right? But they're not the same. They're quantitatively different. But theta means they're really just like up to like a constant.
It's like K log K, basically.
Yeah, essentially it's like constant times K log K. Yeah.
Hamiltonian doesn't have anything to do with the low-level approximation that you were talking about earlier.
You mean the expansion property doesn't have to do with what?
The way it's written right now, you're not approximating anything in the sense of before you were approximating the observable by writing it out.
Oh, yeah. Right now we are not doing any kind of approximation or anything. This is just, we have this. But actually, in the later, you will see one would just replace that H, which is K-local, by this low weight observable. So it's kind of like originally the observable is very high weight, it can have crazy terms. We do this low weight approximation, now it's O low, and now it becomes an n qubit K local Hamiltonian essentially, and then one could apply this kind of proof.
Are you still going to talk about that step if you choose the observable to be like the Hamiltonian, how you do the reduction?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about a little bit later. Right now I'm just going to focus on this very different task about kind of you wanted to maximize it or minimize it. Try to get an advantage over the purely random state.
When you phrase like the results that we had about constant degree local Hamiltonians that are geometrically or that have some constant degree bound.
Yes.
When they're triangle free, you get this square root improvement.
Yes.
Dependence on degree. Can you see that from this bound? Sorry, if it's a long answer, we can talk about it later. But.
Yeah, so if I recall correctly, I think when you have the triangle-free additional thing, then it becomes like very close, more closely related to this. But I remember like there's a when you don't have that additional assumption, then you have like a slightly worse result. Then I think the worst in your case it would be that worst result, but here it would still be like this version. So that's where the improvement comes from. Like essentially taking like this holds for any like bounded degree Hamiltonian, this still holds. So I would say like the improvement is there in that you don't impose additional constraint, you still get like the one when you have the additional constraint. So something along that line. But we can talk about it later. Yeah, but yeah. So when comparing with various existing results in the literature, one can explicitly focus and show that this improves upon them. So now what I'd like to do is I would like to talk a little bit about what this algorithm is. It's a very simple and nice algorithm, and I kind of like it. So I wanted to talk about it. And the algorithm is as follows. So we're given some Hamiltonian H, and we would like to find a product state that approximately optimizes the energy. So what we're going to do first is we're going to select a size with the largest values of alpha p. So recall that previously, H is just a sum of a bunch of different Pauli terms. We can order them. There's like single body Pauli term, two body, three body, and four body, and so on. And we're just going to slice it and take a specific case when it's only consisting of Pauli of like say four or three with the largest alpha p. Because each of them, they would have different values. Like maybe the one body terms have alpha p that are very close to zero, then we will not select them. And the two-body terms have much bigger alpha p, then we would select them. So that's the first step. And now what we're going to do is we're going to create multiple replicas of the system. So say if we select a like k equals to 2, then or actually k equal to 3, then we would select 3 replicas. So the number of replicas corresponds to what k we selected. And what we're going to do is in each replica, in the first k minus 1 replicas, we're just going to select a pure random product state. And now what we're going to do is we're going to take this n-qubit system, n-qubit Hamiltonian H, and lift it to nk qubits. So now what we're going to do is we're going to construct a new Hamiltonian called the polarization of H. So it's related to some concept in harmonic analysis and math. Basically, you take H and then you polarize it and to create a bigger Hamiltonian that acts on nk qubits. So there's k replicas here. So the number of qubits here is like n times k. And it's created in terms of this way. So we are just taking, we're going to define what the polarization of a Pauli operator is. And then this is just a linear combination of each of them using the same weight. So for example, if we consider a Pauli observable P that's ZXYII, so in the original system, it's like ZXYII, the polarization of P is the average of the following Pauli terms. So this would be one of them, ZXY, and then II. And then this is the second one, the third one, the fourth one, and then there's a total of 6 of them. Basically, there's k factorial different things, and we average over all of them. So you can think that in each replica by this construction, the Pauli term will only act on exactly one qubit. And then all the other two will be, yeah, on each replica, the Pauli terms will now only act on one qubit, and then it's kind of like separated across them, which will make the following thing much nicer. That is, we take the polarized Hamiltonian, and for each qubit, we just brute force the optimize over what that qubit has to be in order to, say, maximize the expectation value of the polarized version of the Hamiltonian. And recall that when we constructed it, each qubit will only have like a single Pauli term on it, and then the rest would be acting on some other replicas which have already a determined value. So now this optimization can always be done like in an analytical way. So you can always find the global optimum for the final replicas using this framework. And now say we find a vector on the Bloch sphere like this. What we're going to do is we're just going to combine all the replicas, smash them together, and now we would get some product state in the original system. So the idea is really taking the n-qubit system, producing a bunch of replicas, for most of the replicas just doing a random thing. And then for the final one, we do a global optimization to find the global optimum, which can be done efficiently because of the form of this polarized Hamiltonian, combine them together to get this. And then the final step is actually we're going to go from a complete mixed state and take a small step towards this direction. And then by optimizing that, we can essentially get a product state that satisfies this theorem. So now, after having this optimization algorithm, what we're going to do is to prove this bottomless Hill inequality that I mentioned. Actually, before putting out our paper, like a few months ago, people actually conjecture that this is true. There's an explicitly written out conjecture saying that we conjecture that this is true, and then our work essentially proved that conjecture. And the theorem is very related to this optimization algorithm. It essentially relates the spectral norm of an observable, which is how big the eigenvalues are ranging in the observable, to the Pauli coefficient. So naively, you can easily prove such a bound when you focus on the 2 norm of the alpha p. But what we're going to essentially shown here is that you can relate it to a norm that's smaller than 2 norm, something between 1 and 2. And that's very important for learning application, because if people know a little bit about like compressed sensing, usually what happens is suppose you have an unknown vector with a one norm bound, then suddenly you can learn that vector very, very efficiently. And this is essentially the sort of idea we're going to play here. But instead of having a one norm bound, we have something that's like an R norm bound, where R is between 1 and 2. The more precise statement is, looks like this. Essentially, it says the spectral norm of O can upper bound the R norm of this Pauli coefficient, which means these Pauli coefficient has to be approximately sparse in a sense. And the proof idea is very straightforward. Basically, we just take the rigorous guarantee from the algorithm from before, and then we use the fact that the spectral norm must upper bound the absolute value of the energy that we found for the product state. And then by doing some massaging, we can get this inequality. So here are some also useful examples to help understand this result. So suppose we have an observable that's just a sum of geometrically local terms. Then C is a constant, D is 1. And we can just plug everything back in. And what we get essentially says the one norm of the Pauli coefficient is upper bounded by the spectral norm of O. So in that case, it really means like this alpha norm, like this Pauli coefficient must be sparse in some way, and then you can learn them efficiently. But more generally, in our case, our observable O is not a geometrically local term, but actually a sum of arbitrary k local Pauli terms. In that case, using the expansion property, what we get is this inequality, which says that the alpha norm under this 2k over k plus 1, which is a value between -1 and 2, can be upper bounded by the spectral norm of O. So this is the more exact quantum analog of a classical inequality called the Bonnenbloch-Hill inequality. Okay, so now we're going to finally be back to the original talk. So recall that the quantum problem we're looking at is we have a product state, and our hope is to be able to predict what's the z1 on the output state. And recall that what we have done so far is using this low weight approximation, all we need to do is to learn this observable O low, which is the sum of k body terms. However, there's still a lot of k body terms. There's like n to the k of them, which is quite a lot. Because even for a small n, there's still a lot of them. And our claim is that we only need to take this capital N to be a small number. And the reason comes from this inequality that we just obtained through a very long detour. So essentially, when you have a vector that have a norm that's less than 2 norm, like some 1.5 or 1.75 norm, that's bounded. You can see that on the right-hand side, because k is just a small number, so that 2 to the order k log k is not too large. And then you also have the spectral norm of O low, which you can say it's maybe it's like 1 or some value. When you have that upper bound on this norm, it essentially says that this high-dimensional vector alpha is approximately sparse. There's going to be a lot of numbers that are very close to 0, which you can just throw away without changing the observable too much. So using that insight, what we can get is the following machine learning algorithm for this restricted version of the quantum problem. So we have this classical data set. We just go through all the Pauli terms. We utilize the Fourier transform lemma to estimate what these alpha p are. And then when we saw that this estimated alpha p, which we wrote alpha p hat, is quite close to 0, like it's not 0 because of statistical fluctuation, but if it's quite close to 0, we just set it to be exactly 0. So by doing that, it actually kills a lot of statistical fluctuation and allows one to use a much smaller amount of training data than if you don't have this step. So this very, very simple step, like if it's small, it's set it to 0, actually improves the sample complexity significantly. Without this step, you would need a sample complexity that's roughly like n to the k, which is a pretty large polynomial. But now with that step, you can just make it into log n. So that's kind of a magical step that's happening here. But it's very simple, algorithmically very simple, but the proof that it works is very complicated. So now what we get is the following. You can show that for any small constant epsilon, given a training set size of n equal to log n, the prediction error, like the learned observable O hat low and the true one O low, can be upper bounded by epsilon times the spectral norm of O low from just a log n amount of sample. And then utilizing this kind of a low weight approximation, we can show that the learned low weight observable O hat low will be close to the true highly complex observable O up to an error epsilon plus the term that comes from this part. So like this. And finally, we can also take into account what the prediction error is. Essentially, the scaling with the prediction error would be quasi-polynomial. So if you wanted to really get a very small prediction error, there would be a quasi-polynomial factor that goes in. But the dependence on system size is still log n. So yeah, so essentially, what this result says is that while the classical problem is exponentially hard, the corresponding quantum problem where we have like an average case random product state is actually quasi-polynomially easy.
Sorry, can you go back a couple of slides?
Yeah.
So I want to understand, you say that you need only log n training.
Yes.
You have to calculate all these alpha hat p's to know whether they're small or not.
Yes, yes, yes. So the complexity is, the computational complexity is still n to the k. But it's the number of training data. It's small.
So you don't keep it, you just throw it away. So all the ones that are small. So you're saying you don't need to keep them, but you still have to do them.
Yes. During the computational time, you still have to do it. So that's why the computational time is still quasi-polynomial, but the sample complexity is logarithmic. So that's essentially the resolution for the restricted version of this problem. And now we can go back to the original one. So recall that the restricted version is when we have product state and we only care about z1. And that's not a very specific, particularly interesting case. What we would be more interested in is the ability to be able to predict for an entangled state, and then what's the output property. In particular, we might be interested in more general classes of observable, such as the sum of different local observables, and so on. And in order to do that, the classical data set we are going to look at is very similar to before. We just prepare a bunch of random product state, evolve under the quantum process, and perform random single qubit measurement. Each qubit, we just random in the random Pauli basis, and do that for some repetition. So one way to think about this is a version of the classical shadow of quantum process. So previously, we have proposed classical shadow of a quantum state, which doesn't have this part. You just have a state, and then you just perform some randomized measurement. But now for the quantum process case, you just feed in some random product state, and then perform random product measurement at the end. And there are some other works that also look at this. But in their paper, what they show was something like, when you try to do this, it actually grows. Many aspects grow exponentially, like the sample complexity, the number of measurements you need to do grow exponentially. But using all these previous techniques that I just mentioned, the number of training data you need actually only grows logarithmically in system size. So now, by doing that experiment, essentially you can construct this classical data set that kind of contains hidden information, contains information about this unknown CPD map E. And the classical data set is essentially a bunch of input-output pair saying that when you have this product state input, that's the corresponding product state that you measured. So it's not the output state, but just the product state that you measure when you perform the measurement. So now we are given this data set. And the question is, how can we make prediction when we wanted to, say, understand when we put in an entangled state role and measure an observable B at the end, how should we do that? And the way we do it is also, again, combined with like classical shadow. The idea is that when you're given this observable B, which you didn't really measure in the experiment, you can still take the information about B and then combine with this classical data set to generate a new classical data set that essentially consider the following. It's like it turns it into a data set that says you have n qubit product state input, and here is a real value yl, where the expectation value of yl is the thing you want. So by using this format, which is, this is essentially the classical shadow formalism or randomized Pauli measurement, you take the trace with this observable b, now this value will, from our previous paper, will have the guarantee that its expectation value is the correct one that we care, and furthermore, the variance of it, like the fluctuation in it, will be upper bounded by the shadow norm of b. And now we need to bound the shadow norm. And what we're going to do is we're going to utilize this generalized quantum Bonnenbloch Hill inequality again, because in particular, if we focus on observable b, that can be written as a sum of geometrically local observable, one can show that the shadow norm of b is actually upper bounded by the one norm of these Pauli coefficient. And previously, we've seen in the BH inequality, one can upper bound the one norm of these Pauli coefficient by its spectral norm. So, and then here we are assuming that all the values take between negative 1 and 1. So then we can just show that the variance of yl is just a constant. So it's not fluctuating too much, and everything is good. So now we essentially have this. So given an observable, we can turn the classical data set into, like, its product state mapping from to product state into a new data set, which is product state mapping to a real value yl, such that this contains information about the output state property corresponding to this observable b. So now we are almost back to the previous problem, because we now have this classical data set about some observable b, o, and then we would like to be able to predict for some input state what's the expectation value. But the only difference is that in the previous case, the input state is still a product state. But now we wanted to show that this still works when the input state is an entangled state. And that actually applies because one can also prove a version of this low-weight approximation lemma for more general entangled state. Basically, in the previous case, we have the expectation value for a state that's been sampled from uniformly from product state. But now we can show that actually this kind of lemma also applies to any distribution over any quantum state, as long as this distribution is sufficiently, it has some kind of a structure in it. In particular, if this distribution is flat under single qubit rotation, meaning that if there's a probability to sample a particular state rho, then there's also going to be the same probability to sample another state, which is rho, followed by some single qubit rotation. And yeah, so in this case, this, in general, this distribution can contain highly entangled state, and this low-weight approximation still holds. So everything that we just previously talked about would still apply. But there's one small difference, is that instead of having 1 over 3 to the k, we now actually have 1 over 1.5 to the k, which is slightly weaker decay, but still an exponential decay. So an example of such a distribution is, say, we have the initial state rho. It's like the ground state or the thermal state of some generic geometrically local Hamiltonian. One can show that if you have like a uniform distribution over geometrically local Hamiltonian, then the ground state would have this type of kind of flatness guarantee. And yeah, and finally, the full ML algorithm looks like the following. So first, we're given this data set that essentially throws in product state into the unknown quantum process, perform randomized measurement to get a product state outcome. We get this data set of size n, where n is around order log small n system size. And now, given the new state rho and b, the algorithm essentially runs the following. First, it takes b to transform the classical data set into a new data set that contains product state mapping into a real value. We then run this procedure where we go through all the Pauli terms, estimate alpha p hat using this yl, and then if it's small, we just set it to 0. And now we can create this learned observable, o hat low, which is like a low-weight approximation to this very complicated observable o. And finally, what we do is we just take that low weight observable and then apply it onto the state role. And then through the same proof, it would show that this value would be close to the true value that we care about on average case. It would be approximately equal to trace of B E of rho. Yeah, and that's the entire algorithm for the most general case that we could get. And I would like to recap on some of the surprising aspects of this algorithm. So first, essentially what it shows is that we can learn to predict a very deep quantum, like an exponentially sized quantum circuit, up to a constant relative error from only log n samples. However, this is only on the average case. The prediction is on the average case. It's not on the worst case. The worst case is still exponentially hard, as I previously mentioned. It's only when you have like an input state being kind of a generic, then this is true. Oh, is there a question?
Just want to make sure. Here at the beginning, you said the goal is to learn the quantum circuit.
Mm.
But what you actually do is to predict the physical observable represented by operators. In principle, I can also predict entanglement properties, like entanglement entropies. They are not represented by any operators.
Yes.
So is it sufficient to, is having the knowledge of the predictions of the observables enough to predict the circuit?
No. So yeah. So let me check what I wrote. I guess you're asking somewhere around the goal here. Yeah. So it would learn a model of the quantum process such that, yeah, given some properties of input state, it would predict properties of the output state. But as we have seen, it only predicts like observable. So far, this result doesn't say anything about predicting like nonlinear metrics such as entropy and so on. So that aspect, I would say, is still unknown. This result so far only says it can predict linear property, like observables, of the output state. And furthermore, this is not tomography, like it's not process tomography, because we know that for process tomography, the amount of experiments you need to do has to scale exponentially in system size. So this is more like, kind of more like in the realm of like shallow tomography, where you try to learn some succinct approximate model of the process, which allows you to predict all these kind of different things, but you cannot predict everything about the process. So which is different from a true learning. So that's why we call it learning to predict rather than a full learning where you really learn everything about the circuit. So you should also clarify on that. And furthermore, this algorithm is computationally efficient. It's polynomial time when we care about a constant prediction error and quasi-polynomial time for a very small error. And furthermore, as we've seen during the experiments, we only feed in random product states. However, essentially one could show that the algorithm can still predict well for entangled states. And the entire algorithm can be run on a classical computer.
There are questions from Zoom.
Okay. What was it? Question?
Hi, John, please come in on yourself.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if you could comment on the connection between this work for learning quantum processes and the appearance of barren plateaus, which occur in the quantum machine learning area. For example, there was a paper on barren plateaus precluding learning scramblers or trying to learn the scrambling unitary inherent to a black hole. So in my mind, that represents a quantum process that's an example of a quantum process that can't be learned. Could you just comment on kind of what I may be missing or how
this work fits? That's a great question. Like, I would say in that case, it's more like you're really trying to learn the exact unitary, like in the paper by Los Alamos people. They're trying to learn the exact unitary, and then in that case, there would be barren plateau. However, if you only care about like predicting properties, like you wanted to be able to predict that given some state, what's the output state property, then here we're showing that you can do that efficiently. And actually, the resolution of this seemingly kind of paradoxical results is that for scramblers, everything, the output property is just going to be very boring. It's like everything concentrates, and you can even just predict a constant. So So that learning task, in our view, which is you just wanted to predict output property, is actually a trivial one. So you can always do that efficiently. So yeah, on the other hand, in their case, they're trying to really learn the unitary up to like diamond distance close, for example.
For sure. A quick follow-up question to that then. Like the paradigm of variational quantum algorithms is this process of trying to learn the unitary that accomplishes some task. But if this algorithm provides you with the ability that given an input state, you can predict the output observable, does this maybe provide an alternative paradigm to the variational quantum algorithm approach, where rather than trying to learn the unitary, you just try and learn how to predict the process that you're trying to facilitate anyway?
Yeah, that's also a good question. That's my motivation for looking at this problem. Like, people have been thinking about variational quantum algorithms a lot, and there's a lot of problems, like in rigorous guarantee and so on. It's kind of related to my original motivation about training quantum neural networks and so on. But this is really try to formulate a different way and then provide rigorous proof that this actually works. So yeah,
that's very exciting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Could you comment on what this implies for quantum advantage for quantum dynamics that you mentioned in the beginning? I should also say I'm thinking from the perspective of not so much digital circuits, but analog Hamiltonian simulation. And I thought, well, you're kind of saying that the Hamiltonian is redundant. There's too much information in there. But I'm not sure how to piece that together with people saying if you have a Hamiltonian, you can just let it evolve and measure. Advantage.
Yeah, so I would say it's related to also one of my previous paper about power of data in quantum machine learning. So there's two different tasks. The first is we're just given some circuit, like maybe the Hamiltonian and some evolution time, and then we would like to produce the outcome. So this algorithm doesn't give you that, because this algorithm actually requires you to have some training data that you can train the model, and then it will work in that way. So once you separate it, so there's a purely computational task where you don't get any training data. You just are given some Hamiltonians, and then you would like to predict the output property. And people are thinking that, oh, there should be a quantum advantage. So this work doesn't, I wouldn't say sabotage or anything or affect anything on that, like that. So that I would say still remains unchanged. This work mainly talks about a related problem, which is you're still wanting to do the same thing. You wanted to predict property, but now you are given some examples for some simple states, what's the output property, and now the task begins with additional information, which is the training data. So these kind of the availability of training data is more typical in like a learning task. So I would say this could potentially affect the advantage in a more learning kind of paradigm. Like if you wanted to train your Hamiltonian or your quantum circuit so that it can produce some function that is hard to compute. It could still be hard to compute, but it might be easy to learn, so that you can just run this algorithm. And like everything here, like this whole circuit, you cannot. It's going to be very hard to compute. Like if you don't have this training data, it's really because you're having this training data, and now suddenly you can predict accurately. So I would say that's in that paradigm, And yes, when you have a training data, then suddenly the landscape of advantage could change. Because of this training data, it could kind of, when there are certain problems that are originally hard to, originally there's advantage, maybe in this case, when you have training data and you're looking at a learning task, the advantage suddenly disappeared. So that could happen.
Or maybe from a very pragmatic point of view, if you only have limited access to a quantum computer, this is what you would do.
Yes, this will also be helpful, right? Because if you each experiment is very costly, then now what you might want to do is you want to learn some model of that. You run the experiments for a few times, create a model, and now you can just use that model to make more efficient prediction. Yeah, so I think let's go through these. There's a question.
So two or three slides back, it was with the, I think one more back. It's like the inequality where you kind of extended the truncation.
Oh, this one.
Yeah. States. I want. Can you like explain the intuition about how this works and why, like, the importance of this flatness property?
Hmm. So actually, my intuition is that whenever you have a distribution over quantum states, so that these quantum states are not like just orthogonal to one another, like they have some overlap. Like maybe it's like a smooth distribution over quantum states. I would expect something like this to work, because at the heart, like going back to the original, like the one that I started with, is really because when these quantum states they're like not distinguishable, like not perfectly distinguishable from one another. So then you can kind of have this phenomenon where knowing this tells you the other and so on. So as long as your distribution has this kind of property where it's kind of smooth, and then things that are nearby are also has some probability, then I think this truncation type of lemma would appear, although it's very hard to prove that it appears in the general setting. Like, it's an open question in our paper, but.
Do all T designs satisfy that property?
Yeah, all T designs satisfy that property.
So it's like a pretty large.
But actually, all kind of random circuits satisfy that property. Mm-hmm. And also, if you have some arbitrary distribution over state, and then you just append like one depth one random circuit that creates a new distribution, that distribution will also satisfy that property. So it's really like kind of like the bases are not highly pointed in a special direction, then that property intuitively would be satisfied. And I mean, yeah, in general, intuitively, these lower approximation would work and this whole thing would go through. So yeah, so to conclude, in this work, we give a computationally efficient ML algorithms that can learn to predict the output of a quantum process, where the quantum process can have arbitrary high complexity. And in particular, our result highlights the potential that ML models can predict outcomes of a complex quantum system or complex dynamics much faster than the process itself. And that's it for my talk. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for the free talk. Any questions?
Thanks. So in the last part, you had this restriction on the input state having this uniformity property, right? But I was wondering about the observable. Like, are there similar restrictions on what the observable?
Yeah. So right now, the restriction on the observable comes from using classical shadow. So there is some restriction on the observable for classical shadow. For example, here, we are restricted to considering the observable to be a sum of local observable. So that's a restriction. It's not an arbitrary crazy observable, but only a sum of local observable. But I expect that because there are several developments in extending shadow tomography for quantum states, I think there's a bigger class that would also work. But then in that case, it will require you to perform more complicated experiments that involving some quantum memory and doing entangled measurements and so on. But using this very simple one where you do randomized Pauli measurement, I think you're mostly restricted to this class of observable.
Yeah. So did you say the bound in the separable case tightens when you go from qubits to qdits? Like it was 1/3k, and so if you go to qdits, it would get tighter. But then, like, I thought the bound gets looser as you allow for, like, correlations and entanglement. And can't you just, like, reconsider, like, two separable qubits as, like, 1 4-dimensional qdit? It kind of sounds like if you're doing a qdit, so you have a tighter bound. But when you're accounting for like correlations, the bound loosens.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good question too. let's see. So maybe let's go back to the first one. Yeah, you're saying like here. It seems like, so actually, like here, there's no dependence on n, right? So that's kind of one signal that it's not, when n becomes bigger, it's not really getting worse or anything. Like, this inequality is independent of n. Like, the right-hand side only depends on k. And the intuition that why when you have, like, bigger dimension, it's better. It's actually because when you're averaging over hard random on that bigger dimension. And when you have hard random on bigger dimension, things start to concentrate more and more. And that makes it actually easier. I'm not sure if that makes sense. Like, yeah, it's like they start to get somehow, yeah, their values would start to concentrate. If you go to, like, for example, if you just take the hard random measure over not product state, but an entire space of NQBase system, then this value would just be like if O was traceless, then it would just be zero. So it would really concentrate very quickly. And that's why it actually becomes easier when it goes to higher qubits.
Thank you. Okay, I have a speculative question. So suppose you have an actual quantum circuit of polynomial size and you consider this task. And suppose you want to make a statement about, you know, you cannot do the same thing classically. What form might that statement take? Like, so for example, is there a hope that you could show, you know, using a classical algorithm with a description of a polynomial size circuit, if you could do the same task, the polynomial hierarchy collapses?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that kind of statement out of reach? Or is there some hope of being able to show that the same thing, given a polynomial size quantum circuit, is not, you know, is not possible classically?
What do you mean by given the polynomial size circuit? Like here,
you
the task.
You assumed you had a quantum process.
Yes, yes.
Say it's a polynomial size quantum circuit.
Oh, okay, okay.
And then
you're saying given an unknown polynomial size circuit, for example.
Well, it's given to you.
Yeah. But it's unknown, right? Like you don't really know. Yes.
So then it's given, and then
mm-hmm.
Is there a hope of kind of make statements about how hard this task is classically?
Yeah, so that's also one of my hope for studying all these questions, is like really trying to understand when quantum advantages arises in this setting. But so far, like in this case, what happens is it becomes classically easy when you just don't put any constraint and we focus on this average case. And I think there are some results that says I think it's often the case that they're moving together. Like they're either both easy or they're both hard.
Oh, excuse me, I wasn't. So I mean, I'm not gonna let you run the circuit on a quantum computer to get the training data.
Oh, I see. Oh, you're really saying like given a circuit. But I thought, isn't that just true? Oh, for property tests, yeah. For predicting property, I don't think there's any proof for it. Like for sampling, there are, but for property, I don't think there's not yet anything. I mean, it's BQP complete, so if you can always do it. I see. You're asking like if it's in this average case, and you're given this, you give me this circuit, and I just wanted to predict a single property. Is that task still like that computational task? Is that quantumly hard? I would think so. If it's a quantum process. If it's a quantum process, I think it's kind of trivially true that it has to be.
Even in the average case?
I think so, because the quantum process can just neglect the input. Like it just don't care about the input and it just run its own thing. Right? Like it can utilize ancillas and so on because it's a quantum process.
Oh, okay.
So I think it should. But if it's just a normal quantum circuit, then I think it becomes a little bit unclear, I would say. The quantum process, I think it should be still hard. Like it's as hard as like BQP. Because yes. Okay.
Any other questions?
Broadly, I was wondering if you can utilize this Choi form of a channel in some way. Is there any work on that?
Yeah. So actually, that. That's definitely the first step that one would think of, because like in quantum computing courses, people just say, oh, channels and states are not that different because of this isomorphism. And that's actually the relation that was utilized in this two paper that I referenced here. In there, they essentially really take the quantum process, put in Bell pairs, and then do classical shadow, and then try to use the guarantee of classical shadow for quantum states. into predicting property or process, that doesn't work as expected. And the reason is because when you're doing this Choi isomorphism, you actually, like when you're putting in Bell pair, a Bell pair, when you write it out, it actually like has like this 1 over d factor in it, and which is 1 over 2 to the n. So basically what they get is like every time, like in the classical shadow of quantum state regime, you can learn a lot of things accurately, but now everything has to be multiplied by 2 to the n, and so everything blows up. And that's actually why in that 2 paper, everything blows up is because of that 2 to the n factor from Choi isomorphisms. So I would say in this work, we're really trying to like avoid that in the best way possible. But I think there's definitely more to be done by utilizing some version of like Choi isomorphism and doing smarter things. There's actually a paper by Matthias Caro, who's a postdoc at Caltech right now. And he had a paper about learning Pauli transfer metrics. That is when you have a quantum process, you write down its Pauli transfer metrics, which is like when you put in a Pauli string, what's the expectation value, like trace of P E of Q. And this number is typically exponentially large, divided by 2 to the n, which becomes like between 1 and negative 1. He showed that you can actually, like there's 16 to the n different values of it, but by performing like roughly poly n access to E, you can actually learn all of them well. It's a combination of a classical, like a version of shadow tomography of quantum states that in my previous paper, it's actually this Pauli thing that I actually talked about like 2 months ago here. I talked about how you can learn all the Pauli operator in a quantum state. It basically combines that with like Choi isomorphism to get this result. So I would say that's definitely still a fruitful connection to be utilized in this context. But here we're not really utilizing them.
So I have a question. Can you comment on like how that they deal with error?
Oh yeah. So it was also shown.
I think you have the quasi polynomial.
Yeah, it's a quasi polynomial scaling, and a precise form looks like that.
What's the best dependence like?
Oh, you mean like?
The principle is like maybe 1 over epsilon.
Actually, I'm not sure. Like because I don't know. Like it might be that this is the best one could do. It could be. I'm just not sure because the. We're using low weight approximation, which is very close to like low degree polynomials and low degree approximation used in classical theoretical computer science. And usually when people use that, you often get some kind of quasi polynomial scaling. So it might be that this is fundamental, but maybe there are some smarter ways to do it that can get around it. We don't have a lower bound that says this is the best. So.
Okay, let's thank you for a great talk.
Thank you.